Well, the Festival of Open Minds looks to bring some of the nation's big thinkers to our regional community. There's always a place for local voices to take centre stage and add their own weight to our conversation this afternoon. Our panel of oomph boasts people from the hills and beaches of the Bega Valley and Yurrabadalla, locals who've been spurred into action by a need they see in their community and in themselves. Let me introduce you to our panel of local leaders. Louise Brand was enjoying retirement with her husband David when he was killed while riding his bicycle with friends in a road rage incident on Mount Darra Road in June last year. Louise now has a new life mission: to change attitudes and raise awareness to make our roads safer for all. Please welcome Louise Brand. As a kid, I always wanted to be Ray Martin on the Midday Show, and I'm feeling a bit like this now. My dream job has finally come true. Erica Dibden is passionate about food, provenance, sustainability, agriculture and nutrition. Along with her husband Nick, she manages a large family, an even larger herd of Jersey cows in the burgeoning Tilba Tilba cheese and dairy business, Tilba Real Dairy. Please welcome the best cheesemaker in town, Erica Dibden. Warren Foster Jr. is a Derrinjan performer and creator and founding member of the Gulaga Dance Group. He runs the regular Friday hip-hop event at the Grand Hotel in Bega and is a mentor for the music development organisation Grow the Music. Please welcome Warren Foster. Like many people around Australia, Darren Jones wanted to do something in the response to the Tathra bushfires in March last year. What happened next was the Band Together Music Festival, which raised $160,000 for the Mayor's Bushfire Fund. Band Together 2 is happening this November. Please welcome the Festival Director, Darren Jones. Kate Toyer said she wanted to do two things when she grew up: be a veterinarian and be a girl. As a veterinarian, married with children in 2011, she told her wife that she wasn't a normal guy. In 2015, Kate started her gender transformation journey. From the Yurrabadalla, please welcome Kate Toyer. For Hannah Dool, civil disobedience is how things change. Since finishing school in Bega, Hannah has been at the front line of climate change action in Queensland. With the support of Bega Valley Shire Councillor Kathy Griff and the Bega Valley Greens, please welcome home Hannah Dool.
Ooh, what a powerhouse we've assembled. I don't know where to start with you guys. Darren, perhaps we can start with you. This time last year, the Yankees Gap bushfire was burning. Indeed, the 15th of September was the second run of that fire. It came 6 months after the Tathra bushfires. You responded in a way I think that many people identified with, but you went on to create the Band Together Music Festival. Amazing response, an amazing result. What was it that turned that feeling for you, that oomph that you had, into that action? What was it that drove you forward?
Probably a couple of things. One, being part of this community since 2011. I transferred here from out west at Finlay.
You're a police officer.
Yeah, on my journey through the police, I spent 25 years as a police officer in this state and retired last September. So I was on the front line up in the Blue Mountains back in 2001, evacuating people out of their homes up there when the fire front come through there. And I've seen the devastation that comes from a bushfire of that nature. So Tathra was no different. So it wasn't really a question of should. It was just, this is going to happen. And I made a decision pretty much inside one phone call with a friend that we were going to do it.
Tell us of that phone call. It's one thing to feel something, but then it's another thing to put something into action. What was the significance around that phone call? Who were you talking to?
I was talking to Mick Marshall, who's a local guy and sound and production guy, and sort of we bounce the idea back and forth about, well, how do we do this? Can we pull this off? Given that we'd given ourselves a ridiculous time frame of 7 weeks to pull that together, Yeah, it was pretty much hit the ground running, and then there was no time to even pause and think about it from that point.
Warren Foster, I see something similar happening in your community, I think around young Derinjan people. There's a connection there that seems to be bringing the community together, friends working together to create something really special. There's a bit of oomph there. Can you put it into words? What's going on for young people in the region?
Well, there's a whole heap. So, he's done everyone. Yeah. So just as of recently, helped organise an event with Casey Hill. It was a one of the first hip-hop events held here in the Bigger Valley. It was it's Cypher Friday. We held it at the Grand Hotel in Bigger, down the road near the lights. And it was crazy to see, and it's interesting to see how we treat our young people and how our young people are within this community. See, we often forget about the young people and that they have a major place in the community and building the future of the community. See, and this is where we have to then put these things in place and create these opportunities to do that. And with a simple opportunity, we as individuals gain so much. Not only that, the community gains so much from what we give to the community as individuals. It's just about creating opportunities for young people and showing them there are things and that we do stuff and have the ability to do stuff.
Louise Brand, terrific to have you part of our panel of Oomph this afternoon. How are you going with your Oomph? This is a day-by-day journey for you. The community is about to gather on the 22nd of September to ride from Bega to Tathra. It's the ride for David. How are you going with your Oomph, your journey?
Okay. I have good days and bad days. I have learnt that it's okay to have bad days. Being able to talk to people and being able to have relationships with people, I think, is so important. I feel that our society has got a lot of problems with compassion and tolerance in the community at the moment, and I've personally been affected by that from road rage, and I just feel the need that we have to do something about it. And for me, the best way to do something about it is to talk about it, and that gives me a sense of justice that I'm doing something to try and help what happened in my personal situation, but also to help what's happening in the community. And I think if we can keep talking about it, then I think that we can make a change. I think we can do some changes.
That process of grief is different for everyone, but there seems to be an empowerment about your grief, about the loss of David, that is helping you through?
Very much so. I've never been a spokesperson for community issues, and I have learnt that there is a lot of empowerment from that. I get a lot of strength from knowing that I can perhaps get the government to start talking about road rage issues, because I don't think enough's being done at the moment. I don't think there's enough discussion out there in regards to legislation. I certainly don't think there's enough discussion out there in regards to education in the community. And I don't think there's enough out there regarding enforcement of our laws. It has empowered me to be active and to try and make a difference to what's going on.
Erica Dibden from Tilburil Dairy. Everyone in this room, everyone in this community wants to see a better deal for farmers. You and your husband Nick and your family went out and made a better deal for yourselves. Tell us about those early days of, I guess, walking away in a sense from that structure of the industry and creating your own business, creating a different way to do business for dairy farmers in a way. Do you remember those early days?
I do. It was reasonably bittersweet, because whilst you had the security of supplying your major processor, which meant a cheque was going to come every 14 days, you were slowly falling into the poverty trap of being trapped as being a farmer and not being able to pay your bills. And so we decided to take control, because we wanted to see our own business flourish and to see community flourish. But it's become so much bigger than that. It's become more about nutrition, it's become about community security for our food security. It's just become more than just producing milk and putting milk in a bottle.
There is, you say there's more than just putting milk in a bottle. There is a real community that is building around what you guys are doing, around your products. You're doing more, I assume you're making money, but you're doing more than just making money here.
We are, and we're just really still trying to develop our business to see how we can remain sustainable well into the future, which benefits not only us, our children, the people that we employ, their children, and the prosperity in the community in general. But I think that for me personally, it's more about our food. What does our food represent to us? What do we want to see in the future within our own communities here? We've got duopolies, we've got lots of control, we've got lots of legislation that makes farming very difficult, very financially hard. We've got climatic issues, we've got all of these things that are against us. And so do we keep producing dairy? Is dairy too expensive to produce? And so it's all these things go through my mind to say, well, if we weren't going to be producing dairy as a main protein source, what other avenues are available to us? So it's, for me, it's about making sure that we have long-term food sustainability.
Can you help us understand that value equation? Because value in the dairy industry seems to be a hot topic. $1 a litre milk, it always seems to come back to that point. Clearly we need to value what you and your husband do and other dairy farmers. Yep. More than we do at the moment.
Okay, for fear of sounding like a whinging farmer, I don't want to play that old fiddle, but to put it into context, a lot of farms are running out of water. If you don't have water, you can't farm. A cow drinks 120 litres of water a day, and if we have we've got 500 head, 220 milkers, that's a lot of water just for the cow for that. Then that's not even what it takes to actually run your plant. So you've got drought has that compounding issue. We have drought across Australia, so the feed, apart from the Gippsland area, which is in mud at the moment, feed prices have doubled. So if you think a cow eats 6 kilos of grain a day and grain's gone from $280 to close to $600 a kilo and you're buying in 30, 40, 50, 60 tonne a month or every 3 weeks, it doesn't take much to say, well, how much should milk be worth? What value do we put on our food? We put this food into our bodies. It sustains us. It sustains our environment. Where do we see this ending? Do we want to go to our local shops and buy local food, or are we happy to have everything bought in externally? We can grow what we want at home. It's very hard to grow enough to feed your own family completely, though some people do that. What is the end game with food production? So I see that the responsibility is not just with farmers to say, you must be environmentally responsible, you must be fiscally responsible, you must have good animal husbandry practices, but the consumer has a responsibility as well. Now, I'm a consumer. I'm very careful about what I buy. I put my money where my mouth is. I buy local, I buy fresh, and I support businesses that I want to see surviving well into the future. And I think that when I say food security, that's what I'm talking about. It's us. What do we want in our community here in the future? If you go into a supermarket, go into a general store, what do you want on the shelves? How do you want the food industry to look in the future? We could have mass production, we could have dead food, we could have, and then it's declining health, and I just sincerely feel that we should be supporting, and I'm not saying this just because I am a purveyor and a manufacturer of food, I'm saying it as a human being who is conscious about what she puts into her body, into her children's body, her husband's body. There's an ethical and long-term sustainable question around that. Thank you.
Hannah Dool, welcome home.
Does it feel funny to be back? You've been on the front line of climate action. You've been arrested at the Adani site. You've been arrested on the streets of Brisbane recently. You're out there taking this argument right up to people. What was that tipping point for you that took you from Bega to Queensland and on the front line of climate change action?
I think it's a funny one. It's not so much a tipping point as a general dissent. The more you are aware of what's happening in the world, the less you can ignore it. And I think to talk about taking direct action and civil disobedience as an issue of motivation is almost the wrong frame of the question. I think it should be more, we should be considering what is the reality for our climate and our future, and where do I fit into that reality? And once you start thinking about that more and more, you come to the point of realising that climate change isn't about protecting the polar bears or saving the forest. Of course, those are things I really care about. The reality of what we're looking at for the climate in the next 20 to 30 years is uncontrollable feedback loops. And as a result of that, crop failure, mass starvation, civilization collapse. We're not talking about issues on the side that are for the privileged and, you know, an optional extracurricular consideration. We're talking about a matter of survival. So I think that's why, well, after getting initially involved, I think probably from living in such a beautiful place, I was like, oh, environment, I'm interested in that. And then once you start looking into it more and more, you kind of realise where it's at. It's not an extra thing to add on to your life. It's an issue of survival, and it's really the most important thing and the most pressing thing for our civilization at this point in time. So that's where I'm at.
Hannah, we're having polite conversations here around this topic. Many of us are doing our bit at home, but you take that to the next level. What is it about taking that action, that civil disobedience that you and your comrades on the front line in Queensland do? What is it about taking that action that you think brings to this argument? How does that advance this argument, this debate around climate change?
Okay, so the reality is that we've known about climate change for a very long time. It's true the fossil fuel companies hid it for a good 20 years, sending out propaganda so that people thought that fossil fuels were fine for the world. But eventually that truth did get out, and for the past maybe 20 or 30 years, we've known about what's been happening, and there has been good, polite conversations and letter writing and lobbying of politicians and all of those things that are really important aspects of a campaign to create change as far as we've known them, and they haven't worked because we are entering the sixth mass extinction, and all of those efforts have been ultimately futile, which is a crying shame because so many good people have put so much good energy into doing those things, and they have been ignored by a system which has incredible advantages and incredible investment in ignoring those concerns. So what is going to create change at this point is anything that is disruptive. If you're not being disruptive, you'll be ignored. And so that's why civil disobedience is where we're at the moment. It's where the change can be forced, because if people aren't working, if people aren't allowing there to be cars travelling the roads, if people aren't allowing those bulldozers to clear that beautiful Wangan and Jagalingu country for that Adani mine site, then they can't just continue with business as usual, which is ultimately going to kill much of the biodiversity on Earth and very possibly the human race as well.
You and your friends cop a fair bit of flack for this. You stop children from going to the hospital, you get in people's way, you make people late for work. But clearly this is something you see as a community service. This is your vocation for the time being.
Yeah. There's so much media hysteria around anything that is disruptive because we are very much taught to just go with the status quo, not to ask for anything too much, just carry on. And it's that carrying on that has allowed horrible things to happen under our very noses, the wars we've been a part of, the genocides that we've been complicit in. The status quo of our society is very sympathetic to oppression and very sympathetic to suffering, and it's not the way that we'll create a just society. So I would say that it's true while the Murdoch press has been very vocal in condemning the people that are fighting for change as serial pests and other dehumanising terms. It's because they've got a great investment in continuing the systems of oppression that, you know, give them cheap oil and allow them to continue exploiting people. And that if they start to recognise what's happening as a genuine fight for survival and as a fight for a more just world, then they'll have to relinquish their power, which has put them in such a privileged position in the first place. So the media that is negative against us doesn't affect me too greatly. It's when politicians and other members of our society that everybody who doesn't openly recognise as betraying our best interests, which is the vast majority of people, when they promote violence or promote hatred and increase oppressive laws towards the people fighting for change, and there isn't like an outrage about that from the general public, that's concerning because it shows a level of apathy that is deeply ingrained in this centrist society. So I think what needs to happen is not necessarily for the Murdoch to stop being so extreme, it's for all the people in the centre to recognise where they are and know that silence is always going to help the oppressor, not the oppressed, and so to take a bit of a step back and then speak up about what's happening.
Kate Toya, speaking of challenging the status quo, you started to change your gender in 2015. This is still relatively new for you and your friends and family, I bet, but can you give us a sense of what that feels like prior to 2015, that feeling of oomph, if I can describe it like that, within you, that forced the change within you?
Well, it was actually before it was publicly. We transitioned fully in 2015. So a lot of the transition process had actually I'd been undergoing prior to that and sort of... And I had told my wife in 2011. And what it sort of, I guess the reason I had to transition, and most trans people will tell you that they need to transition, is because you end up so dissonant with who people think you are and who you actually are that you end up at a point where you can't function. And so you get to this point and you just sort of, you can't, you've tried for 30 umpteen years sort of to change yourself and you realise maybe it's not me that needs changing, maybe sort of it's the way people see me sort of that needs changing. The oomph, to a certain extent, was selfish. Like, it was survival because I could not see how I could survive and still function without transitioning.
These are big conversations to have with your wife in 2011. These are amazing people around you to have these sorts of conversations and to be with you.
And my wife, who unfortunately wasn't able to be here because she's running around after one of our children, who's going to dance lessons, is amazing. Like, she is incredible. And you have many very emotional conversations. It's a big change. There's a lot of the changes. It's a big change, and you strip everything back, and you sort of, and we did, and we sat there and we stripped everything back, and we sort of said, okay, and we had the discussion: is this a journey we're going to go on together? And we stripped everything back, and we still loved each other, and we said, okay. This is where we're going to go, and this is a journey we're going to take. And this is a journey that sort of, and it's not just sort of, and my kids went on it as well. And we did, everyone who transitions, everyone who sort of transitions gender, every family who has a family member who transitions, the family goes on a journey together. And there will be people in this audience who have a friend, relative, child who is transitioning and will be on this journey, and it's not. And there's also not that one point. Like, it goes on, and all of those people around you are amazing and incredible, and sort of you couldn't. I don't know how I could have done it without my wife or my children, who are incredible and amazing and also prod the bear every so often, as children do, but sort of, yeah, so.
Catherine McGregor spoke at last year's Festival of Open Minds and she said, "I wish I'd done this much younger. I wish I'd done this decades ago." Do you feel similar? I guess I'm thinking there are a lot of young people in the room, perhaps they have questions around their own identity, their own gender. What do you say to those young people and what do you say to the rest of us? What do we need to know about this?
Yeah. And I think, and sort of, and it's a great question and I think it's a really valid thing. And when I was a child, I wanted to be a girl, but the only boys I knew who grew up to be girls were show girls or sex workers. Neither pathway was a pathway that I felt was for me. And if you'd asked anyone at that point who they knew, did they know anyone who was transgendered, most people would say no. Now, if I ask this room, how many people here know someone? Put your hand up. Do you know who knows someone who's transgendered? Yeah. Sort of. Okay, everyone, put your hand up. That's how many people know someone who's trans. You may not know it, but that's sort of, there is, you will know someone who is trans. And I don't regret not transitioning when I was younger. There were things I shelved that aside. I was sort of, and that was, everyone's journey is different, and that was the way I was able to do it. I do not view that with regret. There are certainly times when I look back on photos and I sort of go, that's weird. Sort of when you see yourself from 20 years ago or 30 years ago, that's odd. But I don't feel it with regret. However, what my oomph now is to create the space to allow people who are gender diverse to be themselves, to express themselves safely, because it's still not safe in a lot of situations. You know, still constantly, every day, I get a story, people asking for advice on social media because their child's been rejected by sort of one parent or another. It's still not a safe thing. You want to create that space. I knew I was trans when I was 7, but I couldn't do anything about it. You bury it, you put it aside, move on. Well, I moved on. Some kids can't. And they shouldn't have to. No one should have to do that. You should be able to be who you are.
Darren Jones, you not only did it once, but you're about to do it twice. Band Together 2 is coming along. What sort of energy did it take to turn around from the first one and do it again? What's driving you this time round?
I don't think we've actually stopped since the first one. Behind the scenes, there's a lot of hard work going on by a lot of people, not just myself. I'm just the figurehead, and that list of people is too long to go through right now, but I love every one of them dearly. And coming out of Tathra, I guess, obviously, as you said at the start, the Yankees Gap fires and the people that were affected by those and, you know, the three or four properties that were affected, in my opinion, just because it was only a couple or a handful, doesn't make the devastation and the loss and that incident any less relevant or any less impactive than what was Tathra. I guess it put a little bit of perspective. I understand that public perception isn't always reality, but I've been working since Tathra and the concert out there at Kallaroo with Christy McBain. And I thank her for her efforts in working with me to, as of about 3 weeks ago at the last general meeting, the council did vote unanimously to finally move forward with the establishment of the Bega Valley Disaster Relief Fund. It's important for this valley, and as I look at the room, there's not one person in this room that may not need to make that phone call one day to ask for help from that fund. And my aim is every year with a concert, it's twofold. Yeah, there's the monetary side of tipping some into that bucket every year and letting that bucket grow. The important thing is that after that grows and upon the next disaster, God forbid that never happens, but inevitably, something will happen in the Bega Valley. We live in a harsh climate now, and when that does happen, we want the assistance to be immediate. We don't want to have the situation where by the time the concert came around and the mayoral appeal was established, people are displaced for a long time on an auntie or an uncle's lounge. They've got kids to feed and they need assistance immediately. So the idea of the fund is that it's much more liberal in scope and what it's able to do, and we're able to help people in many more ways than what perhaps the mayoral appeal did. I understand and I appreciate and I sympathise with the restrictions that the mayoral appeal had around it being for Tathra, and it appeared like they were unable to do much for the guys from Yankees Gap. This fund, Band Together, is all about making sure that Yankees Gap and the lack of assistance those guys got never happens again. It's unacceptable.
Thanks, Darren. Nicely said. And I just want to acknowledge, I know there are people here that are still wrestling with the impacts of the Tathra bushfire and the Yankees Gap fire, and you continue to be in our thoughts. Warren Foster, I can see your wheels spinning up here, listening to these guys sharing in this conversation. What do you take out of what you've heard, and what can we all take out of what we've heard for you and your community?
Well, we have a look at where we are right now. All right. What is the image that we perceive of ourselves as Australians? Well, what do we perceive? Right, there's so many different diverse cultures that are living here, and the oldest living culture in the world lives right here. See, so it's like, what are we projecting out into the world? See, there's so many different stories and there's so many different things that put us right here. Our life adventures put us right here. Our parents' adventures and all that, they put us right here to be in front of you. See, so what are we now? What do we project to the world? What does the world perceive of us? See, Australia could be one of the greatest countries in the world. And it's, we have so many great aspects, but we're following shit countries. Now, with the following of these countries and how their systems are working, it's putting us and falling us into the same exact category. And it's terrible for us. See, and with us putting all our eggs in one basket with the mining stuff, it's missing the bigger picture of who we are and what we give to the world as Australians.
We're following shit countries. Let's get that on T-shirts, hey? Let's get that on T-shirts.
We could be great, but we're following shit countries.
Louise Brand, how can the people in this room, how can the community get behind you and what you're trying to do? You're after a coronial inquest into David's death. There's the Bega Tathra ride coming up on the 22nd of September. How can people get behind, support you and what you're doing?
Can I just say first, I agree with Warren 100%. And Warren talks about what sort of society do we want to be? How do we want to project ourselves as Australians? And at the moment, I feel personally that we've lost our place, we've lost our direction. I think that we are becoming a more intolerant society, and I think we need to show more compassion. And as Warren says, that's on the world stage. Where I'm coming from, it's at a more personal stage. It's from just being tolerant on the roads, understanding what the road rules are. A lot of people don't understand that in 2016 there were safe passing laws passed in New South Wales. And those laws say that drivers can now cross double lines quite legally. A lot of people don't know that, and you can cross double lines quite legally to avoid a cyclist. I would like to see that out in the community. I'd like people to understand that and to talk about that. Next Sunday is the Bega to Tathra Safe Ride, which is a great community event. Support that. Be involved in the community. Get out as a family. Get out there with your friends. Enjoy yourself. Get out in the exercise. As Hannah says, we live in this beautiful environment down here in the far south coast. Get out there and enjoy that. Support that. Be tolerant on the roads. Take time to think that if you're passing someone on the road, whether it be a cyclist, whether it be a skateboard rider, whether it be someone on a scooter or a motorbike, these people, they're someone's husband, wife, daughter, son. Just trying to think that there are people out there. Be safe on the roads. Take time. Be tolerant. Take a deep breath. You'll only get there a few seconds earlier if you want to try and be a bit aggressive on the road. Be more tolerant, be more compassionate, and we'll save lives. And we'll be happier people together. We'll be a society together. Get back to be a community together, which is what next Sunday's promoting. Let's be a community together.
Erica Dibden, no pressure, but I'm hoping for some closing wise words from you.
No pressure.
Clearly we have a choice in all the decisions we make, in all the choices we make every single day, including our food, where that comes from and who we support.
So I've heard some wonderful words up here from the people on the panel and yourself, Ian, and it seems to me that the central theme is about community. We live on the coast or inland because we want to be part of community. We like small... I can't talk for everyone, obviously, but I assume we all like living in this area because we like to feel part of something. So we need to all take responsibility, whether it be for how you behave on the road, whether how we feel about our environments, whether our young people in the community, different people that are doing different things in the community, and we need to choose how we want to see our community in the future. So to be aware and to be mindful of the choices that we do make. I don't think I can come up with any amazing words to finish this. But
don't undersell yourself. I think
you
just did the job.
Warren would like to finish for me.
Yeah. So what it is all about is our job as individuals, and the individuals make up the community. See, so when it comes to what we eat, work and... So, yeah, we know where the food's coming from. We know if we do re-engage with the native people, we have more understanding of the land that we live on. When in that there helps us out with fires and stuff. And then even discovering more further foods that is a major thing, foods. See, we only seem to be eating one food source at the moment, and that is leading to this climate change action. See, and it's all around the greater, bigger picture. See, if we invest within our communities and invest within ourselves, then the economic growth of the community, then as a bigger input then to the region, and from the region to the country, and then projected out to the world. And it all starts with us.
It's really great to have some of our country's big thinkers and big minds here in Bega, but I think what these people prove is that you don't have to go too far to find people of big thinking, of big hearts, of big passion. They live and walk amongst us. Please thank our panel of oomph.